Welcome to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau from Compassionate Cooks. I founded Compassionate Cooks to empower people to make informed food choices, to debunk myths about vegetarianism and animal rights, and to encourage people to live according to their own values of compassion. You can learn more about who we are and what we do by visiting our website, CompassionateCooks.com. First and foremost, before we get started, as you know, I'd like to thank my listener sponsor first today. That listener sponsor is Caitlin Jones, who wrote an email to us saying, "Hi, Colleen. My husband and I have started listening to your podcast and bought both of your cookbooks and have had so much fun cooking with them. When I was about 11 years old, I became vegetarian after my older sister told me about something she had read about how they slaughter cows. I was completely devastated and became a militant vegetarian. A few years later, my mom met a man who was vegan and who preached veganism to everyone in the area. And after hearing from him that animals were mistreated for dairy and egg products, we both became vegan. She was 54, I was 13. For about 9 years, I was vegan, and then in college, I started getting away from the vegan culture and my mom's friends, so I started to eat some animal secretions. Yuck. That's her yuck, not my yuck. I stayed vegetarian, but I let myself be convinced by my other family members and college friends that I would never find someone to marry if I stayed vegan. They said I would be baggage to anyone, so I stopped. My mom stayed completely true to veganism and even cried when I became just vegetarian and not vegan. In the meantime, my brother and I started a wheatgrass growing and sprouting business, wheatgrasskits.com, which has been going strong for about 10 years. During this time, I met my husband, who came to work for us from a meat packing plant. He wants to write you his story. I want to hear it. And he became vegetarian after first coming over, and we started dating after he had been working with us for 6 months. And then we got married 2 years later. It was a miracle to find a husband who had the same heart towards animals as I do. All of my college friends were wrong. We tried and tried to become vegan together, but we just couldn't do it. We drank soy milk and those easy type of things, but to go fully vegan seemed impossible. From the moment we started listening to your podcast, it was like the easiest thing in the world to be vegan. And we're not junk food vegans like we were vegetarians. We were junk food vegetarians before. We make weekly trips to the farmer's market. We're loving it. We also have a 7-month-old baby who will luckily now be vegan for her entire life. Thank you for all you do." Love it. Another magical email from another magical person out there. So awesome. Thank you very much, Caitlin, for your support and for all you do. If this podcast has helped you in any way, please consider becoming a Compassionate Cooks member. You can go to CompassionateCooks.com to do so and sign up at the level of your choosing. A quick note, some people have opted to have their membership payments come out monthly on their credit card as opposed to using PayPal, which is the default system for us, and it really works for most of us. Doing these monthly payments manually, it's definitely more work for us, but we wanted to open that option up. What's happened now is I'm using another service for these monthly payments, and because I recently switched, they require more information than we have from members. They require a zip code and the security code. So there are some members who were signed up, and we've emailed them several times, and they have not replied to us with their additional information, and we're not going to be able to keep their membership going, which is unfortunate for all of us because I want to keep giving you benefits, and obviously we need to be able to keep your membership going through these payments. But we haven't been able to get in touch with you. So if you're one of those members where you know that your monthly charge is done manually by us using your credit card, please email us as soon as possible, podcast@compassionatecooks.com, so we can keep your membership going. But thank you to everybody. Thank you to all of the members and all of you listeners. Could not do this without you. Could not do this without you. So welcome to part two of Critters on the Street, When to Intervene. Most of us can identify with seeing a dog or a cat running around and either not knowing what to do or trying to help and not succeeding, or convincing ourselves that they'll find their way home without our help. We've all been there. I remember when I was about 13 or so, I saw a dog running around our front yard. And this was a dog I had never seen before and who definitely looked lost, very sweet and friendly. My mother had never been an animal lover, so it took a lot of coaxing to let me bring this little critter into our apartment. And of course, I was already in long-term solution mode, figuring out if we could keep this little terrier, if we couldn't find her people. But my mother was adamant that if we couldn't find where she belonged, then we'd have to call the pound, as it was ominously called then. And I think I convinced her to give me a few days. I can't quite remember the time frame in which all this happened. But during this time, while I convinced her to let me find this dog's people, I called the local shelters. I put flyers up. And a couple days later, I got a phone call from someone who was related to the dog's guardian. It turned out there had been a car accident, at which time the dog ran away from the scene several miles from where we lived. And the guardian was in the hospital from the accident and had been very worried about her dog. So she was thrilled to know that he was safe with us. And so the day after we made contact, some people had come to pick up the dog, some friends of hers, and I cried and cried and cried as I handed him over. And of course, I was happy that he was going to be safe. And of course, I was happy that he was going to be returned to his people. I had already become attached. And I think for me, at least, that's one of the most difficult parts of rescue. This is why I'm in awe of people who can do fostering. I mean, that's why I know a lot of people who foster wind up keeping some of the animals they're fostering. But I just become attached very, very quickly. I'm very sensitive. And I just become attached. And I'm not attached in the sense, what makes me upset is not, oh, I want them as mine and I want to keep them. That's not really where that stems from. It's more that I want them to know that they're loved and they're safe and they're not abandoned. And I think one of the things that breaks my heart more than anything is the idea that they would feel abandoned or alone, that nobody cares for them. And it's that sense that they don't belong to someone to protect them that makes me really sad. And that goes for all animals, not just these dogs and cats we're talking about on the street, but that idea that all these billions of animals who are killed for human consumption, that nobody knows them, that nobody loves them as individuals, that nobody knows, that nobody's named them. And it's that sense that really goes right to my heart. And that's what's so hard when I bring an animal home, or, you know, rescue an animal or foster an animal or whatever. I remember a couple years ago, it was October, November 2008, and I was walking with a friend around her neighborhood in Oakland, just at the Berkeley border. And it was really funny because this was a friend with whom I had made a date to go on a very quick walk with, because I was meeting David at a restaurant for dinner, and then we were going to a movie, and I didn't have a lot of time. So my friend and I were squeezing each other into our schedules, which was pretty typical of us. And so we decided to just go on a quick 30-minute walk. I think we had like 25 minutes to go up on a walk and catch up with each other. And then I would go and rush and meet David for dinner. So we're walking around the neighborhood and walking rather briskly when out of the bushes jumped a little cat right in front of me. And I know I said this about Charlie, but it's true. I mean, it's as if she was waiting for me to come by, pounced, you know, jumped out of the bushes and jumped right in front of me. And she started meowing, and she was so adorable, so gorgeous. So I knelt down and she jumped up on my lap, and she was mewing in my ear, and she was just so affectionate and sweet. And as I pet her, you know, she was long-haired, so she looked kind of mangy, but I mean, she looked okay. You couldn't tell how thin she was, but when I touched her, it was obvious that she was really emaciated, that she was starving. And she had little scabs all over her neck, all over her chin, and she had clearly been infested with flea bites. So I started looking around, and nobody was outside. And so I asked my friend to knock on the door of the house that we were right in front of. And so a woman and her little girl, who must have been about 3, came to the door. And as I held this little kitty, who was loudly purring in my ear by this time, I asked if she had ever seen this cat, and if so, who she belonged to. And the woman said she did not know her, but she'd been seeing her for the last few weeks, and that sometimes she would put food out, but she didn't know whose cat she was, and she didn't want her to become attached to the house because her husband was allergic or something, and so she just put food out periodically, and I don't know, you know, I mean, she was clearly trying to help, but clearly this cat was emaciated and needed more intervention than just that. And so, you know, I just, at that moment, I was in a rush. I was right in between, you know, where my house is and where I was meeting David. And I couldn't leave this cat. I mean, I could have easily said, well, she's taking care of her and fine. You know, I could not leave this cat. I could not just put this cat down and walk away. I couldn't do it. So I said, look, I'm going to take her. And she said, well, let me bring my girl inside because I don't want her to see you take the cat away. She's become attached to this cat. Okay. So she brings her daughter. She called to her daughter, Isabel, to come inside, and they closed the door. And I looked over to my friend and I said, you know, is there any way that you could take this cat for a couple hours, maybe put her in the bathroom somewhere, you know, so that I can go and do this and then come back? Because I had already given David grief for you know, being late. I was encouraging him to not be late for our dinner date. And the irony is that I was going to now be late because I had to go back home. And so my friend said she would not. And I don't really know to this day what her reason was. And I was not happy, and I didn't appreciate that she wasn't helping at all. So, cause she was, you know, a few blocks from here, and I had to drive back home. So fine, whatever. I went into high gear. I said, okay, bye. Gotta go. Grabbed the cat, ran to my car, which was a few blocks away, and brought her into the car and called David and said, look, I'm going to be late, which was fine. He understood. It was no problem. I brought her home. I put her in the animal holding area. Listen to part one to know what I'm talking about. We have an animal holding area, and I gave her food, and I gave her water, and I gave her some kisses, and that was Charlie, and knew she was at least safe until I could come, you know, until the next day I could bring her to the shelter. And so the next morning I brought her outside, and she was just, you know, kind of pouncing around the yard. So adorable, very, very affectionate, very sweet, very responsive. And she was very hungry for both affection and food. And so I was, you know, the plan was that we would get to the shelter and scan her for a microchip, and that she'd have a microchip and we'd be able to return her back home. But I wasn't prepared for what to do if she wasn't microchipped, and she wasn't. And so as soon as they scanned her and determined that she was not chipped, they said, well, what do you want to do? Are you taking her? Are you taking her back home, or are you leaving her here? And it was so hard. The tears started flowing. I felt so bad about abandoning her. Again, it was just that fear of just abandoning her, but I was already taking care of Cassandra and Simon and Schuster, and I needed to be realistic. Also, I wanted her to get immediate care, and I knew she would there. So we decided to leave her at the shelter. And at that moment, the director of the shelter walked in, and I'm friends with her. She's vegan. She's amazing. She has completely changed the Oakland City shelter around completely. So for those of you who live in the San Francisco Bay Area, most people go to the San Francisco SPCA, which of course is amazing. And the East Bay SPCA, but they avoid the Oakland City shelter. And I just encourage you not to avoid the city shelter. There are so many wonderful people doing the work of, you know, they have limited funds because the city doesn't give them the money that they need. And so many volunteers started the Friends of the Oakland Animal Shelter, and fantastic people. I just love these people. So, I'm like crying, and I'm like, I feel so bad. I'm leaving this cat. And she's like, that's what we're here for. It's fine. It's great. We're going to give her the care she needs. Don't worry about it. You know, and it definitely made me feel better. And I left her there, but I tormented my friend every day writing to her and asking how she was doing. And I had named the cat Isabel after the little girl at the house. And so I was writing to her, and, you know, first they had to treat her before she could be put up for adoption. She had horrible fleas. She had mites. She had a cold. She was underweight. So before they could put her up for adoption, they had to treat her. So it was a good month. It was a good month before she could be put up for adoption. And then I watched her little video. They have little videos on Pet Finder, and she was so pretty and she was so healthy. And not long after that at all, my friend wrote to tell me that Isabel had been adopted, and that it was a very nice woman in Berkeley who adopted her. And of course I was incredibly relieved and happy. I asked if she would give them my phone number to call me just so I can, you know, say hi and let them know where I found her if they wanted to know any information, but they never called. But it was, you know, it was obviously a happy ending. As emotionally traumatic as it was for me, it was the right thing to do. It was the right thing to do for her. It was the right thing to do for Simon and Schuster and Cassandra. I simply cannot take in every animal I find. I know a lot of you identify with this. Yeah, and that doesn't mean that I can't work on finding a home for those animals that I do find. Of course, I've done that too. I don't believe that it's the sole responsibility of the city shelter to take care of all the homeless animals on our streets. They're mostly overrun, they're overtaxed, they're underfunded, and most of this is because people aren't taking responsibility for society's animals. We think it's someone else's problem. We think that someone else will take care of the problem, or we're not thinking at all, which, you know, is part of the outreach and education that all of us have to do about getting animals spayed and neutered, et cetera. But we have this disposable mentality. We think someone else will take care of the problem. And I think that's, you know, that's a big part of the problem, and we can be part of the solution if we all took responsibility. I think it is our responsibility. I don't think we have an option. I think we have a responsibility to take care of society's members. And I think it would be a very different story. I think it would be a very different picture if we all took responsibility and learned where to draw the line. But, you know, imagine what would happen if we lost our animal. We would want someone to intervene. And just imagine what these animals feel like when they're, you know, kind of alone or hungry or in pain, etc. Now, most of my stories of rescuing animals have had happy endings. Well, that's not true. Actually, they have all had happy endings. Most of the situations have been dogs who had tags, so I was able to keep them here and, you know, safe until their people could come to get them. Those dogs who did not have tags, I was able to find their people because I know my neighbors, and we have a very active listserv on our street, which has been immensely helpful for a number of reasons, particularly in the case of lost animals. One night, late at night, a few years ago, I was driving home, and I was at the bottom of my street, and walking around, just kind of aimlessly walking around, was this beautiful, huge, fluffy white dog in the middle of the street, just walking around. It was like 11:30 or something, and I really felt bad, but I called a friend who at the time lived nearby, and she has dogs because I needed treats and I needed a leash because the dog wouldn't come to me at all. He was very skittish, and he kept walking away whenever I tried to get him. And so my friend came over, brought treats, brought a leash, and after a short time, I was able to get the dog and bring him home, put him in the animal holding area with some food that she brought and some water. And the next day, I put a note out on my listserv, and I also called my friend across the street. And people knew who he belonged to. Our street is there's a hill, and I'm at the top of the hill, and obviously I interact more with the people who are in my area, so I didn't know who this dog was, but my neighbors had. And so I called his people, they came to get him, he was home, no problem. Lesson learned is that I always now have dog treats in my car. I always have a water bowl, I have cat treats, and I have a leash, and I also have towels in the back of my car. So that was definitely a lesson learned from that, because I really felt bad calling my friend so late. And now I don't have to do that if I ever find a dog. So for those of you who can make this happen, I definitely recommend creating a network with your neighbors for this very reason. On our listserv, I also started a photo album. It's just a Yahoo group. You can do a Yahoo group or a Google group or whatever. There's so many networking sites out there now. Just use whatever makes the most sense for your community. I started a photo album so everyone can upload pictures of their animals, their dogs, their cats, their rabbits, whatever. So we all know who belongs to who in case they ever got out. And this will be especially helpful if, heaven forbid, there's ever a natural disaster and the animals flee their homes from a fear or stress. You know, and we live in earthquake country here, so that's definitely a concern for us. We've had our own emergency preparedness meetings with our neighbors, and so this is one area in which we all have to be prepared. So with photos up and kind of knowing who our animals are, I just realized I should have some kind of meet our neighbors' animals night. That would be so cool. So we could all just go over and meet who the animals are, and they could even smell us and get to know us so that they wouldn't be scared of us if they needed our help. That's such a good idea. I think I'm going to have to do something like this, like a little party with the neighbors, doing a meet and greet with the animals. Hello. Love that. Love it. Okay. I'm going to do that. Anyway, so the whole idea is that we would know each other's animals so that we can help them. And that's an example of not overtaxing the city shelters. This is an example of us taking responsibility for animals, because In a case of an emergency, normally, hopefully, the animals go to the shelter. And if we knew our neighbor's animals, you know, within a reasonable vicinity, at least a block, then we'd be able to return them to their people without having to bring them to the shelter. So that's an example of how we can help and not overtax the shelters and help the animals and help their people. Now, I don't know all of the animals in every house around my neighborhood. Clearly, that's why I'm going to have a party. But because I do spend a fair amount of time walking and running around my neighborhood, I cannot tell you how many times I have seen animals who needed intervention. More than once, when the animal was already dead, this has happened as well. And so even though I couldn't do anything to help that individual, you know, by that time, I was able to bring peace to his people and to his body. A few years ago, David needed me to drive him down to the bus stop, which is only a mile from our house, but we were both in a rush. Surprise, surprise. And he needed me to just drive him down so he could get there quickly. And as we turned down one of the streets here, I saw a black cat in the road who appeared dead. Now I had to keep going and drop David off. And then I came back up the street, and from the other side, I could see that the body was still there. Now I was in a rush, and part of my brain was trying to convince me to not intervene, that he was dead, that someone else would call animal control. And that lasted about a minute. So I quickly drove home. He was about a quarter of a mile from my house. I grabbed an empty box and a towel, and I came back. And I parked and went over to his lifeless body, and he was already getting stiff, but he was still warm. And he must have died from internal injuries because there were no visible wounds. There was no evidence that he had been hit there on that spot. And I had never met this cat before, but when I touched his body to pick him up off the street, I cried. And I cried for whatever suffering he may have experienced. I cried imagining him trying to get home after being hit by a car or just whatever happened. I cried thinking of him dying alone. And it was very touching, and it was very sad. And thankfully, he wore a tag. So I wrapped him in the towel, I placed him in the cardboard box, and I brought him home. And I immediately called the number on his tag and got an answering machine. Now, some of you may not have wanted to leave a message about this kind of thing, but I really wanted them to know as soon as possible. I didn't know if they screened their calls, you know, I didn't know. So I just left a message, and as gently and compassionately as possible, I told the stranger that I'd found her cat in the street and that he was not alive, but that I had him with me. And within an hour, she called back, and she was completely devastated. She came right away to pick him up, and she really just couldn't say much when she arrived. She was really grief-stricken. So she called me about an hour later, and we spoke for some time. She was so grateful that someone had cared enough to pick him up off the road and keep his body safe from being mangled, you know, by oncoming cars. And she told me all about him and how he came to her and what his personality was like. And it was very cathartic for her. And it was an honor for me to help her. And, you know, I never heard from her again. And I passed that spot, I don't know, a million times a week, both on foot and in the car. And I think of that kitty every day. And this happened several years ago. So it's not only the live animals who need us, giving a dead animal dignity, which is really what that was about. Help, you know, obviously giving her closure, but also giving that animal dignity in death means a lot to me, whether I find their people or not. I've buried animals myself, wild animals, domestic animals. And so I think it's a real honor to be part of that process. The lesson here is to definitely collar our dogs and our cats, because we can get them back to their homes and contact their people as quickly as possible. Microchipping is a great idea. A lot of people microchip, but then they don't put a collar on. And not everyone's going to bring an animal to the city shelter to see if they're microchipped, if they find an animal. But if they see that there's a tag and they can bring them, you know, right to their home if they're nearby, then they're more apt to do that. So tagging, I think, is, you know, putting a tag on with a phone number is really, really important. So as I said, the majority of my interventions have been positive and with happy endings. It's a matter of keeping your eyes open and just being willing to help, you know. And to be honest, being willing to help is not a decision you make on the spot. Being willing to help, being willing to intervene is a decision you make long before you leave the house. It's really a commitment you make as a rule. And once this is part of your consciousness, the universe recognizes you as an aid. And believe me, you will be used as an aid. I am telling you, I do not look for animals, but they find me almost every time I leave the house. And sometimes, even when I don't leave the house, like in the case with Cassandra, she just came to us. Now, one time I had driven a few yards from my house when a dog crossed in front of my car. He was clearly, well, lost. I mean, I don't know if he was lost. He was just out of his element. He clearly wanted to get back home. He wasn't in his home. He was walking around the street. And surprise, surprise, I was in a rush. I'm learning to slow down. This has definitely been a lesson for me in slowing down. But I was in a rush, but I pulled over and I got out of the car and I tried to coax this dog over to me. And there was someone else on the street nearby and I asked if they knew him. He didn't. He kept walking. And the dog was barking at me and not letting me near. But after a short time, I was watching him. After a short time, he walked over to a gate and he paced around this gate. And I put two and two together. I realized this dog was out of his yard. And so I walked closer to the gate. And sure enough, the latch was loose. And as soon as I opened the gate, he ran inside. It took all of 5 minutes to return this dog to his house. And I went on my merry way. Another time, not very long ago, actually, I was running around the neighborhood and I saw a little dog, no more than 10 pounds, who was kind of chasing after this couple who was walking their own dog. And he didn't look like he belonged to them. And I asked if he did, and he didn't. And they said that as they passed by his gate, he jumped what must have been about 6 or 7 feet. And I'm not exaggerating. This was like a wrought iron gate that had kind of, you know, those spiky things on top. So it really was about 7 feet tall. And there was wire all over it. There was trellis attached to it. Clearly this dog had escaped before and the people had really tried to keep him in. You know, he was outside and alone, but they had tried to keep him in because he clearly, you know, had springs on his paws because he was able to jump 6 or 7 feet in the air. And so clearly they were trying to get him back into the yard. And so I just figured, okay, they're taking care of it. So I'm just going to keep going. And so I ran and then I, you know, kind of looped back doing another mile and the dog was still outside his gate and the people were gone. So I gotta help this dog get back into his gate. He's this little guy and you know, it's kind of a main street. So I didn't want him to get hit by a car. And I was trying to figure out what to do. The people weren't home. I knocked, I rang and I would not have been able to stand on a chair even and kind of lean over with this dog because I would have had to drop him 5 feet. So I didn't know what to do. And he was barking, but he stopped barking eventually. He was just trying to be tough. He actually eventually he trusted me. And at that moment when I was trying to figure out what to do, the house next door had a side door and it opened and a woman stepped out and I said, "Oh, hi, do you know this dog?" And she said, "Yes, he lives there and he's escaped before. The people aren't home." And I said, "You know, I really hate to just leave him. I can't just leave him. Would you mind can we put him in your yard until they get back?" And she said, "No problem. Absolutely." So I brought him over to the backyard and, you know, problem solved. And David and I were passing by another time and there he was again outside his gate. The people weren't home and there was a chair on the porch. Luckily, David, because he's 6'3", was able to stand on the chair and lean over as much as possible and drop the dog only about a foot and a half and he was fine. So we were able to get him back in. Easy problem to solve. No problem. So if you ever see a dog kind of wandering around a gate, it's probably his gate and he just has to get back in. You know, so it's just a matter of putting two and two together. One time recently, I was coming back from a run and I was passing a house right around the corner from me and I saw two rabbits hopping along the driveway. I didn't know if these people had rabbits. I'd never seen rabbits before. I don't know who these people are, but I knew that they run a daycare center out of their home. So I figured, daycare center, kids, rabbits. So I knocked on the door and they came to the door and I said, "Do you have rabbits?" And they said, "Yes, we do." And I said, "Well, there are two rabbits hopping around your driveway." And she shouted, "The rabbits got out. No, thank you. We'll go," you know, and they went and took care of it and it was all great. But otherwise, the rabbits would have been hopping around, probably not safe. A dog could have passed by, whatever. So it doesn't take very long often. It's just a matter of keeping your eyes open and being willing to just, you know, take a few minutes out of your day to help someone. Sometimes I've intervened and, you know, I wasn't really needed. Sometimes I haven't been able to do anything at all. One night, it was an evening, not very long ago, David and I were walking around the neighborhood, and we were on a side street where we had looked at a house many years ago when we were house hunting. And so we thought, let's go down this street and let's go find that house, see if we could remember which one it was. And as we were approaching another house, I could hear screaming coming from this house from inside. I don't even remember what he was saying. This guy was screaming. He was so angry. Well, fine, if that's what you want. Just screaming. And it's really disconcerting to hear someone in such a state. And I couldn't help standing in front of the house, kind of in shock. And he's screaming and he's swearing. And finally, the storm door opens. And he flies open and he says, so get the F out of here. And out walks a little black and white cat. He was screaming at the cat. And I said, oh my God. I said, is everything okay? And the last thing this guy expected was for someone to have heard his tirade. And he was still at the door and he said, it's fine. It's nothing. And I said, what happened? What could a cat have done so bad that deserved that? What, is everything okay? And he said, you know, it's something else. It's nothing. It's not him. It's unrelated. It's something else. And I said, you know, as gently and firmly as I could without sounding judgmental, I said, well, don't take it out on him. I said, he's just a cat, you know? And he said, it's fine. It's okay. It's fine. You know, and the situation could have been different. It could have been very different. He could have been very angry with me. He could have been very defensive with me. I was glad he wasn't. But I think part of it stemmed from the fact that I was so shocked that my reaction was, is everything okay? Rather than what the hell is wrong with you? You know, so he, I think, was more embarrassed than angry with me for saying something. And I'm certainly glad it went that way. The cat was there just kind of self-consciously grooming himself. And after the guy went inside, I tried to coax him to come over to me, but he wouldn't. He just stayed there and laid down. You know, and I had to assess the situation. The guy was totally angry, totally inappropriately yelling at this cat. But from what I saw, he did not strike him. He did not kick him. And he had opportunity to. When he opened that door, you know, that was the moment for him to kind of shove the cat out and kick the cat. But he didn't. He was clearly using his voice and not his fist or his feet. So in the context of not being able to solve every problem I see, I can say with confidence that I was not afraid this cat was being physically abused. If I thought that, if I witnessed that, I would have called the authorities on the spot and tried to, you know, take that cat. And I've recently seen the cat since, and he's, you know, he seems fine. And in fact, I swear, I'm not just saying this. I clearly spend a lot of time in my neighborhood. This is my break from working is actually going on a walk or going on a run. So that's why every story involves me running or walking. So recently I was running, and I was crossing that same street where this house was with this guy. And I saw two dogs running around loose, and neither would come to me. And that's the hardest thing, is when an animal won't come to you and they just run in the other direction. So I never chased them. I always try to coax them over, and I didn't have treats with me. I was running. And so they wouldn't come over. And I walked over to this woman who was watering her front garden. I said, excuse me. I said, have you seen these dogs? Do you know who these dogs are? And she looked up and she goes, oh gosh, oh no. And next to her, as she was watering, I could see that white and black cat. It was the same house that where that guy was yelling at this cat. And he was fine. He looked fine. Incidentally, while this woman and I were discussing who these dogs were, a car pulled up and two women got out and began calling to the dogs. And I went over and asked if they were their dogs, and they were. So I was very happy to continue on my merry way. As I said, I'm happy to intervene, but of course it's nice when I don't have to, when the solution is there, when the problem solves itself. Two other times I can think of my help was definitely not necessary. Another time a few years ago, David and I were walking around our neighborhood and we were going to meet some friends for dinner. So actually, ironically, we were in a rush trying to squeeze in a relaxing stroll. Welcome to my life. So we were walking and, you know, kind of conscious of the fact that we had limited time. And this gorgeous, friendly, big, you know, big orange cats ran across the street to where we were and stopped right in front, rolled over on his back, you know, put his belly up, just adorable, sweet. I gave him some love, and I would have just ended it there and walked away, but I checked his collar, as I'm apt to do, because I wanted to see his name. And I noticed that the telephone number had a Los Angeles area code. And flashing back to the incident from when I was a child, I thought maybe he escaped from a moving car, maybe there'd been an accident. I didn't know. So I made the decision to take him home and call that number. you know, we had to go meet our friends right away. So I brought him home to our, what we affectionately call our animal holding area. And I called the number and left a voicemail saying that we had their beautiful, obviously well taken care of cat named Morris, and to call me when they got the message. So we're at dinner and I was totally anxious to hear from these people. And finally the phone rang and it was this LA number. And I said, "Hey, we found your cat and I'm afraid he's far from home." And she said, "Oh, we recently moved to Oakland from LA," which is where she was at that moment. She was not home. She was in LA. And she was surprised that he went so far. And I told her the street we lived on. And she says, "Gus, that seems so far. I'm surprised he walked that far." And I said, "Well, what's the name of your street?" And she told me. And I said, "Oh, I think I stole your cat. I think I just stole your cat," flat out. And we laughed because I stole her cat. I think I couldn't remember the name of the street that she had told me, but I knew it was nearby where we were. And so the next day, we brought him back, and the number she had given me, we checked the number and we looked at the number, and basically the cat had walked across the street to us from his house. So it quite literally picked him up from his house and catnapped him. And yeah, that's what I did. He was probably like, "What are you doing?" 'Cause I had to run home with him. He's like, "I live here. Why are you taking me?" So luckily that was a happy ending and I've seen him since. Another time, pretty recently, I did the same thing. A little cat was walking a few houses down from me. I'd never seen this cat before. I put a picture of this cat on our listserv. Neighbors down at the bottom of the street knew who this cat was and had basically kidnapped this cat, you know, a couple houses from her house. But, you know, I don't do this often. So sometimes you can intervene and you're not needed. But I'd rather err on the side of caution. So certainly the lessons are, you know, definitely have a tag, because this little white and black kitty, this recent one that I catnapped, she was not tagged. She did not have a collar. She didn't have a tag or a phone number. And luckily I used my listserv and they knew who she was. But even with the other people, I know it's hard to do this because everyone has cell phones now these days, but you know, I think having a local phone number on your cat's tag or your dog's tag is really helpful, because people might do what I did and not know, you know, and not realize that they're local. And I know it's hard because cell phone numbers are just universal. And these days it's so hard and you want to keep your cell phone number. But, and then of course, you know, consider not letting your cats roam freely. I'm not a big fan of outdoor cats who just hang out on the street. I think it's dangerous for them. I think it's dangerous not only in terms of cars, but also in terms of just any number of things that could happen. They could be stolen and sold to an animal research facility. Don't think this doesn't happen. They could be stolen and used as bait for dog fights. Obviously, this depends on where you live, but this can be a problem in many cities. There's also the problem of cats killing baby birds or other animals whose populations are threatened by domestic cats. If you do let your cats go out during the day and have free rein, perhaps consider keeping them in at night. Speaking of cats killing birds and intervening, a couple of times I've brought wild birds to my local vet. Most recently, a juvenile robin who had been caught by a local cat. I was able to retrieve the bird, who was still unable to fly. He was young enough that he wasn't able to fly yet, and he was clearly stunned. I could not tell if he was hurt, but I didn't want to take any chances, because if he'd been punctured by the cat's teeth, he could suffer an infection and die a very long, painful death. So I called our local wildlife organization, who sadly isn't able to take in birds anymore because they're understaffed and underfunded. But amazingly, one of our local vets takes wildlife drop-offs, and then other local wildlife organizations come and bring the various animals to their facilities to treat them and release them within a mile from where they live. And so as soon as I arrived, I'd called first to this vet's office, and I took this little chirper who was very feisty and alert by then. And as soon as I took her in, they brought her to the incubator. They have an incubator where the wild care people, where the wild animals stay until the people can arrive and help. So I definitely think in terms of wildlife, it's also important to be prepared to intervene, and important to know when not to intervene. In the case of this bird, he was clearly old enough that he had grown almost all of his feathers, but not quite so old that he was flying. He was way past his just downy feathers. And it's true that I wouldn't normally separate a baby from his mother. She could have been nearby, but I didn't want to take a chance and have this animal die a long slow death. So I also included the address of where I picked him up so that the organization could release him nearby. They released them within a mile. And it's just great to be able to know where a wildlife rescue organization is near you and have that phone number in your cell phone as well. And then definitely learn the best ways to respond when you see a wild animal in need of help. It varies by animal and it varies by age. That's probably one of the hardest things about this, is knowing when to intervene and when not to. Clearly, I err on the safe side, which is why my husband calls me a catnapper. You know, and all of these steps, even the ones that feel the smallest, reap huge rewards, reuniting animals with their people, providing shelter to the lost and abandoned, and just knowing that a few moments of inconvenience for me makes a world of difference in the lives of others is incredibly gratifying. So I hope that's helped. I hope my experience has helped you with some of your own, and always feel free to further this discussion on the message board so you can talk to each other about other ideas. Also, I think I'll make a separate podcast announcement for this, but I have started the Animal Rights Literary Book Club, which I am so excited about. Animal Rights, W-R-I-T-E-S, Animal Rights Literary Book Club. You know, there was a time where I was really hoping I could make an offshoot podcast called the Animal Rights Podcast and just have those short stories that I read, but it's just too much work. So I'm really excited about doing this book club. If you've enjoyed the literary episodes, perhaps you'll consider joining us as we read books that have an animal and vegan consciousness, focusing in this case on novels. We'll probably read some of the short stories and the essays and poetry that I've been able to feature in the podcast, but I'm really looking forward to sharing longer works with you that I can't possibly read on the podcast. So it's the Animal Rights Book Club, the Animal Rights Literary Book Club, and you can go to compassionatecooks.com and under events and classes, I think there's a link directly to this page. It's compassionatecooks.com/book_club.htm, but you can go there from the classes events menu item. And our September selection is Animals. It's called Animals by Dawn LePan. And I hope you'll join us in reading it. It's our September selection. You can read about it on that book club page on the website. It's called Animals by Dawn LePan, LePan. And what's exciting is that we're going to have an online chat each month. In October, our chat about animals, the book, will be on Tuesday, October 12th. So please mark the date and make sure you're on our mailing list so you can get announcements about it. There's also a Facebook page for the Animal Rights Literary Book Club. So please join that. This is where you'll get all the announcements. I don't have the details yet about where that chat is going to take place. We're looking for a reasonably priced service. We've been finding some that they're pretty expensive because we don't know how many people to expect on the chat. But we'll have an online chat on Tuesday, October 12th. And if you live in the San Francisco Bay Area, we're going to have an in-person chat on Thursday night, October 7th from 7 to 9. And if anything changes or for any more information, just check out the Animal Rights Literary Book Club page. So thank you, everybody. Thank you for understanding. Thank you for your commitment to this podcast, for your listenership, for your support, for your voice. It's an honor to do this work. And it's an honor to do this work with you. Until next time, for the animals, this is Colleen with Compassionate Cooks. Thanks for listening.